Unpacking Chrysalis, the art of being human.
We're unpacking. We're learning about people. We're unpacking Chrysalis. Hey, Clayton. How's it going?
Hey, Benny. Pretty sweet. How are you doing?
Well, you know, to quote the 2001 hit song by the band Stained, it's been a while. I haven't seen you on the podcast in a long time. What's up? Where you been? I mean, I know where you've been, but for the sake of the podcast, I'm just going to go ahead and pretend like I haven't. So why you been dodging my calls?
I'm dodging your calls because one of the great things about working here is that every 7 years, we get 7 weeks off to just think about our lives. And the one rule we have is you can't work, and you are part of my work world, Benny. So sorry, just couldn't be there for you. But what was great about it is that, you know, I took a couple months off from late December till mid-February, and I just really had a great time to just reconnect with myself and my family and just think about what's going on, how is it going, and it just was really joyful, and it was energizing. And come back, and I'm ready to rock and roll and get back into this podcast, among other things, so here I am.
Here you are. And now that you're back, we're doing things just a little bit differently. I hang out in the background of all of your conversations, just quietly turning dials and being a producer, I suppose, of sorts.
Yeah, I think this is a nice, this is a really nice innovation that we've done on the podcast, is to add you to the recording session, because it was just me and the guest before. And, you know, I'm just a person. So sometimes you kind of get locked into a frame of mind and then I can't get out of it. So having you there to support me and support the guests, just with some insightful thought or things you're noticing, it really helps me, and I really appreciate you being there.
It was a lot of fun, and you know, the first one we did back was with Ben, and probably couldn't have asked for a better guest to do that with. I've spent a lot of time with Ben in the Vancouver office. What a great opportunity it was to get to know Ben and just kind of like how he functions. You know, I'm so used to just talking to Ben all the time, but I never really think about what makes Ben tick. And then I went for a trip with you on this, and I learned a lot about Ben.
Yeah, it was a really fascinating conversation. I mean, anybody that's met him, you kind of get this vibe from him that there's something interesting or unique about this guy. And I know he gets put in a lot of positions at work where, you know, difficult problems need to be solved. And so what I learned about this guy in there is just kind of how that works, like how that responsibility to solve or be around difficult problems just matches so cleanly with his personality and his interests and his values. It was really fun to unpack all of that.
Yeah, I believe he had a term for it. And I'm not sure how you feel about it. I mean, it gives me a slight chuckle, but yeah, the professional idiot at one point, yeah. Ben calls himself, gives yeah. himself that title.
Yeah, I have a negative reaction to that, but I understand why he's doing that. But that's also part of his charm, right? This is a guy using this really distracting phrase to kind of push you away from realizing what his superpower is. And it's being willing to ask questions. It's being that person who just wants to get us to the right answer, but he's not worried about being right up front. And that's a wonderful skill. And he kind of diminishes it with saying, professional idiot. I totally get it though. And he is. He's great at it.
He is. Well, let's get us to the conversation at hand, and we'll catch you all on the other side.
Let's do it. Hey there, welcome to the podcast. We call it Unpacking Chrysalis, the art of being human. Not because we figured it all out, but just because we're trying to create space for people to come together and figure it out. Our podcast is simply an attempt to get to know the people who work here, get a sense of how they think about things and what gives them energy in life. So today we've got Ben from our Vancouver Bureau. Ben, welcome to the pod. How are you doing today?
I am aggressively caffeinated.
How would you describe your work that you do around here? And how long have you been around here?
So I've been around for just over three years. And I've flown around multiple roles in multiple teams. Officially as a product owner, program manager. Well, the way I've put my role on LinkedIn is the what should we do and making sure it gets done, because that's more than anything what I do. A lot of situations I come into a team that is potentially lacking clarity in a project, or they're partway through and they need to understand when to stop. What is the goal? And so helping unpack that, what are we aiming for? What do we want to achieve? And then attempting to roll that through into completion and making sure that, you know, we can achieve the things we're looking to do. I sometimes joke that I sometimes get deployed as a firefighter. There's this project, we need to pull it back into line, or it's a lot of situations like that when we have an issue and they need someone to kind of rally others around and say, we need to sort this, and then trying to hold those threads until it's sorted and then let it go and on to the next challenge.
Yeah, 3 years. So COVID hire, one thing, that's interesting when we really didn't have offices. And the other thing is just, you seem like a brand new guy and here you are 3 years already. That's fascinating how fast 3 years goes.
I was hired at the start of a large hiring time. And I was one of the first people to be hired when they were hiring a fair amount of people during those times. And I had to learn quite quickly because, you know, people getting hired around me, and I was very quickly realizing that I was expected to be some kind of subject matter expert in things. And there was an amusing point when I hit my 1 year anniversary.
Yeah.
And a lot of people who'd been around for a while, like, oh, that's so great, you know, it's nice to see 1 year, congratulations. And a lot of the newer people were like, I thought he was part of the furniture.
Yeah.
Because was it 4 or 5 months in, I was onboarding new employees, and so there was an expectation that I'd been around a long time. I've not been around that long. So it's been an interesting situation to have to both feel like I've been around for a long time in comparison to the people who joined just after me, because I ended up onboarding a couple of them, but also feeling like, oh, I've been here 3 years. That's nothing compared to some of the people who've been around a long time.
So on this podcast, we always let the guests pick what it is that they would like to talk about. So, Ben, what are we going to talk about today?
I would like to kind of deep dive into luck and the importance of it in success. And then hopefully we can kind of go from there and, as me and you do, Clayton, just kind of meander through all of our thought processes.
That sounds awesome. I'm looking forward to it. This will be a good chat. Let's get at it.
I have a personal take on it, in that essentially any success of any form is almost entirely due to luck, but you can manufacture luck. For example, I've done a lot of traveling, but one of the big things I did was when I was early 20s, I decided I wanted to do 1 year of traveling before I turned 25, because after you turn 25, you never really have a chance to quit your job and travel the world with no fears or no expectations, because you have responsibilities. And so I decided just before I turned 24, I quit my job, I went traveling, and did all sorts of things. And in reality, it could have been an absolute disaster, and I could have, you know, come home in a body bag. But by going out and putting myself out there to try all these random things, some of them worked and some of them didn't. It's the whole, if you, you know, you miss every shot that you don't. What is the phrase again? Oh, every shot you don't take. And so for me, it's like, yeah, in a lot of ways, you have to put yourself into those situations where you can get the luck to succeed, and then you also need the skills to be able to leverage that luck to be as successful as you can be in the chance that you get. So I always think of it as like this: you can be talented, and you can put yourself out there, but you need that spark that you can then take advantage of. And that's kind of one thing that I always try to do. I try to put myself in situations where something can serendipitously happen, and some the vast majority of moments it doesn't. Yeah, so I think that was one of the things we've kind of always vibed on at a level, and the way it works with my work is a lot of times I reach out a lot across the company, and generally, I mean, I like to talk to people, I like to connect with people, but sometimes there are situations where you hear, oh, you know, we need to pass this by a legal opinion. You know, we need some legal opinion on whether this is the right thing to do or not. And yeah, what does Tony think? And like, first couple of weeks in IQ, I kind of bumped into Tony and had a chat and, you know, chilled with him for a bit. And then when this question came up, I was like, well, I could just go ask him. Because if you've made those connections, it's so much easier to just turn around and say, hey, you know, not legal advice, but vaguely, if this is if X is happening, like, what actions should we consider doing? You know, what things do we need to think about? So all the situations, the more you put yourself out there, the more chances you get to have a time when you can leverage being in the right place at the right time.
Yeah. I noticed this about you, that you seem to be the type of person that says, yes, let's try that. And, you know, you've got this interesting example of the Mongolian horseback riding thing. That's an obvious one we'll probably come back to. But actually, it sounds like this started at this point where you said, I'm just going to quit my job and travel a bit. Is this a yes personality in you? Or was this a moment of introspection? It's like, ugh, I better start saying yes to more things.
I think the situation that spurred it on most, and it's odd because it's such a minor thing to have happened, but it was very impactful, was watching, it was like a 6-minute excerpt of some terrible TV show in the UK, but it was essentially a dating show, where they got, you know, four guys or so to do like a speed dating style introduction to a lady. And then afterwards, they interviewed the guys and said, you know, they basically fact checked everything they said. So like, oh, you said you were captain of the football team. Were you actually captain of the football team? It's like, well, actually, when I was captain when, you know, the captain, you know, like injured himself, he was off for a couple matches, and I was captain then. And the one person who was telling the most truth was the person who had the most interesting stories to tell. And he said, why would I need to lie? I'm proud of everything I've done. And at that moment, I was an exceptionally boring individual when I was younger. I realized if I was sat down and asked to talk about myself, I wouldn't be proud of the things that I had to say. So I think at that point was when I had a conscious decision I decided that I wanted to be the sort of person who'd be proud to talk about myself. It wasn't anything about people thinking I'm interesting or impressive. It was more for myself. I wanted to be happy with the person that I was, which has made it very easy to say yes, and also very easy to say no to things. Because do I have a desire to do it? No. Well, then if I did it, then I would not really care in myself. And so, you know, there are some situations where I'm happy to just be like, no, that's not my thing, because it's not about being a yes man. It's not about how I'm necessarily externally regarded. It's about how I feel about myself.
That's exactly actually what I was thinking about as you were talking, What is the motivation? Are you externally motivated by perceptions of others? When you say, I want to be proud of the stories that I tell about myself, or is that actually coming from a place, inside of you to say, I want to be proud of myself and my perception of the life I've lived and the experiences I've had? And then you just answered it. So that is a fascinating level of self-awareness, in my opinion. Just because I largely have lived in the inverse, right? And I notice it has been at most times more important how others are perceiving me, and then that really affects like my actions and my choices and when I say yes, when I say no, and it inevitably isn't all that rewarding, right? When I operate that way, but you're operating more from an internal validation perspective, like I want this stuff. This is for me. Is that a fair way to describe it?
Yeah, I think when it comes to a lot of things I have done, I talk about a lot of, like, when I was younger, I was really into fire performing. I did
Fire
a lot.
performing.
Yeah, so fire
Fire,
poi,
unpack that a bit.
you get a
What's
ball of
that?
fire, attach it to a chain and spin it around from the other side. And I'd say try not to hit yourself, but there were some tricks that involved hitting yourself with fire extensively. And when I was, university and a couple of years after, I really enjoyed it. I was attending like fire performing training camps in Switzerland and Italy. I really loved jamming with other fire performers. And then at one point, I just realized that I'm happy with the level I was at. If I ever want to pick it up again, I can. And I was happy with the experience that I'd had doing it, but I'm moving on. And I'm happy to talk about it as in a way that I'm not saying that I've given up. For me, I was very happy with what I'd achieved, and I'm going to move on to something else now because there's, time to be spent. I spent some time doing bone carving as a little hobby. It took too much time, but I'm happy to talk about my experience, what I learned, but also I'm happy to be like, yeah, I stopped doing it because I wanted to do something else. I think a lot of people have this sort of, if they started doing something, then they therefore have to become, top 1% in the world touring doing it, and then utterly disappointed when they never do. But I think there's a certain, I think people should be more proud of trying something and then marking it as completed, even though you're not the best in the world at it.
This is where you start to maybe think about yourself as a generalist. Is this the evolution of you as a generalist? Because you get to a point on, you're curious and you actually go at these, relatively esoteric things. Bone carving wasn't in my list of things that I did when I was a child, which isn't to denigrate it, but it's a little different. The fire work, as you say, that seems wild to me, but normal to you. That's great. So you endeavor into these things, and then you get to a level where you're satisfied, and then you take on something else. But you're always doing something.
Yeah, generally always doing something. I think depending on the thing, I'll be satisfied at a different level. I picked up the Irish tin whistle, and for me, the breathing and just messing about with it is the joy that I get from it, and I never have any intention of being good at it. With the harp, what my intention was to be good at it, and so I live my life differently with those two different things because I want to get something different out of it. And, with the tin whistle, I can pull it out, play a couple tunes, and it's a bit of fun, and it's never meant to be more than that. And the harp, it's, every so often I kind of revisit how, what are my goals with it? What am I actually attempting to achieve? Because if you're vague about your own expectations of yourself, that's when you end up disappointed. Pointed with yourself later in time, because a lot of people have this desire to, I want to be better at something with no specificity. And then 6 months down the line, since you weren't specific enough in that, and then you, there's little drive to get to that point. And then you just end up disappointed with where you are. But on the generalist side, yeah, I think of myself as a massive generalist. I generally like, I like to understand how complex something is. The way I describe this is I like to exist at the bottom of the Dunning-Kruger curve. So, you know, you peak that first bit of knowing enough to be dangerous, and then you end up in the pit of despair of realizing how extensive this area is. And I find that's a good place to live. When I trained as an industrial designer at university, one thing that we were taught was, you're not a mechanical engineer or an electronic engineer. You just need to know how to talk to them. So we learnt enough about how electronics worked to be able to have a conversation with an electronic engineer and vaguely understand the concepts that they're trying to communicate to you and why this might be difficult. It fits in quite well with my role here because I speak to the finance team, because I'm responsible for a section of the billing system, and I have no idea. I'm not an accountant, but I have to be able to communicate to them in a way that they understand. I need to talk the financial billing talk to them and then translate to, okay, how am I supposed to talk about that to a developer? Like, I need to convert that into developer language. It doesn't mean that I'm in any way a specialist in either of them. I just know enough to know how complicated it is and communicate what needs to be communicated.
Yeah, I think comfort with discomfort at the bottom of that Dunning-Kruger curve, as you say, that's like where we realize we actually just don't know. This is a much more complicated thing than we thought. And I find that for myself, I like to listen to things that I don't understand. I like to read books about things that I don't understand. It's like I kind of enjoy being aware of how little I know, rather than trying to get comfortable with how much I know and be, I guess, biased towards sharing how much I know. So when you talk about this Dunning-Kruger thing, it really resonates with me, actually, just as a place where I'm really comfortable. But I think when you're comfortable in that, it offers you some humility. And so your humility kind of becomes a bit of a superpower of accepting that I don't need to know all the answers. I don't need to be right, but I definitely need to get to right. So in your work, that kind of manifests. Do you see a connection there like that?
Yeah, I mean, at work, I refer to myself as the professional idiot.
Yeah.
Because...
That's wild.
A lot of times it involves asking the stupid questions. Why can't we just do this? To help unpack why something is as complex as it is. And also when someone who knows, you know, the code far more deeply than I gets too deep into the rabbit hole, pull them out and be like, why don't we do this simpler option?
Yeah.
And then hopefully, you know, we won't end up doing the simple option that I've suggested because it won't work.
Right.
But use that to then revise what's going on.
Yeah.
So a lot of times I use that kind of idiot hat to help bring those conversations out and bring us to a place where we can, you know, make things a bit more balanced. Because I generally work with a lot of specialists who... Right. Delve deep into those rabbit holes.
Yeah, they live in there. That's their expertise. That's their superpower.
And I think there's also a lot of people are worried about sounding like an idiot. Whereas me coming in and announcing myself as the idiot in the room means that there's a bit more acceptance of other people asking, well, what about this? You know, I thought we could just do this over there. It makes it a lot easier for others to feel safe because I'm putting myself out there and saying, I'm going to ask the stupid questions. And you're all free to join me if you like.
Yeah, you're modeling behavior. It's really beautiful. If you think about the psychosocial aspect of that, you're modeling behavior for other people so they see you doing that and they realize they can see the value in it. And it helps them overcome their desire to not look like an idiot. And it makes a much better, it makes us more able to have conversations about things that are implied. And it helps get the implicit to become the explicit. And you must run into that. That is like the outcome I see. That's really powerful about what you're describing.
Yeah, I think psychological safety is one of those words that's been possibly, it might be controversial to say, but slightly weaponized. But for me, what it means is we're working on something, and I want to be able to say something that I think will positively impact this thing we're working on. So I'd like to think I'm creating an environment where people feel safe to ask those stupid questions, because generally those ones are the ones that need asking more than any others. And also people feel safe to kind of push back from those and, you know, kind of also create that environment of like, oh no, this is more complicated and this is why. And just creating that space for professional discourse. Because, you know, you don't want people fearing for their jobs if they, you know, don't toe the line, because then you end up with a room of yes men, and that's when the really dire decisions get made.
Yeah. Psychological safety emerged in some research that Google did about 10 years ago now, actually. But what they were trying to figure out is, what is the secret sauce of these most highly engaged, most productive teams at Google? They researched what made the most high performance teams. And the secret sauce, the number one variable, was psychological safety. And all they described psychological safety as is the extent to which people feel comfortable sharing their ideas, thoughts, innovations, insights with their colleagues. And that was the number one. And they were so shocked by that, the researchers, that they actually went back into the data to ensure that that was number one of the top five that they described. And so psychological safety, and I agree with you, it's been weaponized. It's been misconstrued and misunderstood in my experience as everybody has to be happy. We have to worry about everybody's feelings. We have to make sure that nobody's unhappy. And that's not it at all. It's about, can I comfortably share my ideas with the people around me without being shamed or diminished? Will they listen to my ideas and help me develop my ideas? It's the most powerful thing. And so this service that you're offering, just by being, as you described, the idiot in the room, is actually extremely powerful.
Especially when I generally work with, I'd say I work with more teams than most. So the development team that I manage is called Foundations for a reason. It works with the foundational products, the services that every other team needs to work with for every product that we own to be able to communicate with each other. We're the central source for a lot of things. And so being the person in the room who can sit down with two teams who never converse and saying, okay, we need to work together. Let's start thinking of the ways we can do this. I'd like to think that being that professional idiot, I can be the one who can get us to the best outcome and not necessarily the smartest one.
That's right. Yeah. Getting to write, creating space for people to partner with each other. That is one of the critical skills I think that's emerging in our current version of society and how things are working right now. people that can connect the dots, people that can create space for others to share their perspective, and then find the commonalities and the common goals, and then move forward together. Like, that is the partnering mindset that is incredible.
Yeah, it's interesting. We had a conversation about this previously, and it made me a little more hopeful for my livelihood and my mortgage payments, because one thing I've been thinking recently is like the death of the generalist, the idea that since generalism is so general that things like you know, AI would be able to replace those non-expert fields. And so for me, sometimes it feels like there's this desire for the generalist to be taken out of the picture and replaced by AI. And so maybe there's some hope left for me. I think I always say that it's nice to, you know, for people to turn on their cameras, because there's value in yourself being human, especially right now.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, really. I think that in the short and medium term, one thing I notice is that because information is ubiquitous, there's nobody that doesn't have access to all of the information immediately. It's actually the people that can connect the dots that seem to have an advantage in the short and medium term. I'm specifically saying short, medium term, because who knows what right beyond the medium term actually looks like. As you're describing, there's some technologies that are emerging that might fill that gap. But I do notice that. I think that in ubiquity of information, a humility-based mindset, that the professional idiot is the person that's going to introduce the skill set to the room around connecting dots, finding patterns, and sifting through that information and contextualizing it so that it can be applied to the problem of the moment. And I think there's that's just my sense of it. Something I've been thinking about a little bit.
I had a conversation with the team that helps curate products. So when a new iPhone is released, how do we get that into the system? And one thing that I'm sure everybody inside this company and outside is experiencing right now is there's too many things to do and not enough time to do it. And it's really easy to get bogged down. And I'm even a victim of this with the detail of the tasks that need to be done. I have, you know, drilling into a very specific problem with a very specific task. And so having a conversation with them, I had to attempt to pull out a bit and talk a bit less about the very specific tasks, more like, wouldn't it be nice if... And then you have these more general statements, and then see if you can solve for those more general statements, and then see if the kind of task within that is even necessary, or the problem that's within that is necessary. Because actually you're trying to solve something. You're trying to solve something, but your issue is a task that solves that. So if you pull yourself back up, then potentially there's another way that you can look at solving it. And I had a conversation with my lead yesterday about me having the exact same problem. And it's always easier to look at other people and other teams and see the ways that you can pull yourself out of it. But that's why it's good to have a lead, so that you can go to them and say, I have too much to do and too many of these small annoying tasks I have to do, and for them to look at you from an outside perspective and let's pull you back out and let's see what is actually necessary, and what problems are you actually trying to solve instead of the tasks you're doing to solve said problem.
That's the implied and that's the implicit explicit. We get into this loop where we assume that what we're doing has to happen, and it's hard to pop your head up and say, and do an evaluation of that and say, well, maybe, but maybe there's, what's the actual problem I'm trying to solve, and get down to the root of it, and then actually be able to consider other perspectives on it from your own mind. And I guess to be even more controversial, I'll say this is the extreme value of diversity and inclusion. When we include different people to bring their perspectives, the diversity of their experiences, the diversity of their educations and their professional skills, and if you add that diversity to and explain the problem to that diverse group of people, you're going to get extraordinarily strong outcomes in terms of problem solving. Diversity and inclusion is another thing that's been kind of bastardized and really become a cudgel. But I think it, at its root, all it's saying is ask different people to contribute to your understanding of how you might solve the problem. And that's where you get extraordinary strength. There's limits to it, but it is, I think, one of the most powerful things that a person can do.
My previous role before this, because I can't have the same job twice, was kind of cabinetry, interior designer, and production manager. It was many words all smashed together.
A great acronym, I'm sure.
The way that most projects would start would be an architect sending over their interior plan, what they want the interior to look like. And my job was essentially to get these visions of the architect and then work with the plumber and the electrician and the reality of cabinet making. And sometimes the client themselves, because architects have a mind of their own that might be separate from the clients, and eventually coalesce this into a set of drawings. So I do all the drawings, and the drawings would essentially be, this is the room. It would bring all of those different perspectives in, and then we'd have this one section. It would show where all the plumbing fittings are coming through, where all the electrical goes, all the dimensions of everything, so that it was built exactly to this, and everybody agreed that this is how it was going to get done. And you have situations where an architect might have a plumbing line. They'll have an ensuite to a bedroom, and they have a plumbing line which would, based on their drawings, end up in the closet next door. And so by bringing all these people together, all these specializations, the first thing you have to do is stop them from arguing,
right?
Because they're all ruining each other's plans. and then work with all of them to make sure that you have this cohesive vision that is can be built. Instead of, you know, people slicing off pipes halfway through because it's not going to work to what they want. And so when I applied for the role here, that's why I said my skill set that I wanted to bring was as a translator, to be able to translate those different skill sets and know just enough to understand why having a chimney going straight through a bed is a problem.
More importantly, knowing how to ask a question of someone who can make that decision, but asking it in a way that gets them to think of the breadth of the stakeholders instead of their piece. This is a real act of compassion and empathy. I think that's a good segue, though, for to chat with you about this thing about you that I noticed, that you seem to really value human connection and community, and you're kind of a catalyzer of this. And I'm curious, I've noticed this since you've worked here. Is this something that you brought here, or is this something that you developed here?
I'd say both. So when I came into this company, one of the first things I wanted to do was get to know a few connections around the company, and so I could understand a bit more about what people are doing. And I know you talked about empathy earlier. One of the things that I kind of identified was a lack of empathy for teams who you don't know anyone in. So if you're pushing something to production which might break something that another team owns, if you know someone in that team, you're more worried about breaking it. And so in the office, I've got to know some of the members of Cova quite well. And I'd like to think that the desire in my, you know, my services are used by Archimetrics and Cova. And to me, like, having that more direct line of communication and that, you know, sitting next to each other has meant there are situations where I put more of a pause on things. I'm like, nope, I need to talk to Cova about this. Like, I need to make sure that they understand what's going on. And it's so easy if they're just someone else in the ether of a company that's more than 10 people, where you don't know them personally, there's that temptation to not put in that additional effort to make sure that it's going to not affect them.
It doesn't occur to you. It's not a temptation even. It just doesn't occur to you, because it's like, they're not somebody you know. It just doesn't occur to you.
Yeah. And we've made a lot of progress just by occasionally myself and Dave Emmett, who's been on the podcast previously, just sitting down and having a chat and, you know, pulling on a couple of the threads that you wouldn't have otherwise. And so that's the value of connections for me. I've always said that it's important to have a web in the company, and it doesn't have to be everyone connecting to everyone. If everyone's attempting to talk to everyone, it's never going to work. And so having those people, those like channels of information throughout the company to help disseminate information is important, because both some people don't have the time nor the desire to, you know, sit down with every other person in the company for 15 minutes. And it's just not logistically feasible. And so having those people who can connect the web is important.
Yeah. In our, connectors, people who are cultural, not just cultural connectors. I mean, that's a particular thing, but connectors, people that connect ideas and people, have an extraordinary amount of value. Us trying to do this in a hybrid works environment has been an amplifier of the challenge. And I think as we figure that out more and more and more, we'll just be poised to excel in this, you know, this modern workspace. But it is definitely a challenge to figure that out, because I do think that is a critical piece where people understand that, we do have to be efficient and effective in our day-to-day tasks and make sure that we get those things done. But there's this additional level of, there's an experience that's happening. So as we're going about our work, we're experiencing things. What's working well, what's not? How are our clients being affected? How are our partners being affected? Just different stakeholders. And being together makes it more easy for those discussions to happen. Just these not tactical, event-based conversations, project updates, but actually, you know what I noticed with their client right now? This. Oh, I'm noticing that too. I wonder what's going on that's affecting that. And then these general conversations happen. They're not events, they're general conversations. Dots get connected over time, and there's just some real magic in that. And it's difficult, more difficult now where everything's an event and you have to put some time in somebody's calendar, and it's more complicated now. So what is it about being a connector that gives you energy? Your recipe guy, your drinks guy, your events, like you're all often trying to catalyze things. Is that to serve yourself, or is that to serve others, or where does the energy come for that?
I've never thought of it as expending energy for the connectors. I found that for me, when it's a bit of a solo mission, it doesn't feel like it's expending energy. It just feels like a thing that I do. Mm-hmm. You know, I we have a channel where we share cocktail recipes, and at one point I drank a gin that was very nice, and I thought I'll share this with people who I think would be interested in it. I have no desire to just scream it out into the void of social media, and so I know that there's a group of people at work who are interested in cocktails, so I share it with them. And so those sorts of situations, I'm doing something because I enjoy it. In the office at one point, I set up a kind of tea and coffee session where we all came. It was just over my lunch break. I made tea and coffee. And for me, I enjoy making tea and coffee and talking about those things. And so when I do that, even though it was over my lunch break, I'm just like secretly munching off the side. It's something that I would have been doing regardless. I find sometimes with the more scheduled stuff, the more planned stuff, I have to push myself to be involved, because at that point you're not necessarily doing something just because you find it interesting. You're doing it for a wider purpose, and sometimes you may or may not agree with it. But there, you just have to understand that there is value to doing things that you're not necessarily as interested in. But also, you can just enable other people to follow their passions. If someone wants to do an event which is not your cup of tea, then you can support them and, you know, encourage others to join in and let them enjoy doing what they do.
What you're talking about is something that is really powerful. There's, again, it's about compassion and empathy in my mind. But when we can do things that benefit the group, even though it doesn't necessarily benefit us, it just adds to the community. It adds to the sense of community, the support. I even like it when I notice people doing things that will benefit people in the environment, in the workspace, that they never will meet. Like, they just, whether it's good documentation or something like that, they will never meet the people that might use this, but they're contributing to the environment because they know it's the right thing to do. And I kind of am drawing that connection to what your motivations are. You're just nerdy about things, and you're doing those things, and maybe people will be interested and enjoy them as well. And it just seems like that clean and simple and innocent. Is that fair?
Yeah, it is just a me being excited about something, and either I would be doing it alone or sharing it with others, and I have no reservations with sharing things I'm interested with others. And so I'd rather give an opportunity for people to be involved, and if they want to, that's great, and if they don't then they don't.
Yeah, what a great approach, right? That's, again, you doing it for yourself to the benefit of others, but not because of others. Because if you did it the other way, if your motivations were external, you'd be disappointed when not enough people contributed and not enough people participated. And so it gives me a much better sense of how you're getting energy and giving energy. So, yeah, that's pretty neat.
That there's always people doing good things, and as long as people are always getting value out of the things that they're doing, for me it's important to just make sure that that's happening, that there's something important is being done.
Hey, I have a thing that I realize, if I can interject, and you guys can talk about it like I'm not here, and I can edit around it. But I do think that there's a connection from the beginning where Ben, you talk about creating, you know, wanting to do things that you find interesting about yourself, not to impress other people, but this idea of exploring interesting things. You're doing that. You're doing the things that you find interesting for you and sharing it with other people. But then you're also making space for other people to bring the things that they find interesting and share, and giving them room to do that thing. So it feels like kind of a full circle moment of, hey, now everyone else gets to have that version of the dating show where they get to talk about are they really interesting? Are they saying yes? And I think that was an interesting connection from the beginning to where we are now through everything.
When we were in our old office, I started something that I just called the Minivent series, and it was just every month a little something. And it kind of spanned from like when the office started opening back up after the COVID times to the point when we were looking to relocate offices. And there was a point when I'd done a few of them, and one of the coworkers was like, oh, can we do an ice cream event? I was like, go ahead. That's a month I don't need to think about. And so being the, you know, setting things up, building a bit of structure, and then seeing if other people are interested to run with it. And sometimes they're not. And I think that also ties into the things don't have to last forever to be a success. You know, there was the ice cream session, and then there was another session after that. And then, that office closed down whilst we were relocating. And for me, I personally thought that was success, because every month when we had something happening, more people were coming each time. And when the office reopened, maybe people were like, oh, that was kind of fun when we did, you know, these mini events in the old office. Maybe we'll turn to this one. And so for me, I considered it a success because that was my criteria. My criteria was I'd like to do something every month, which just during my lunch break or at the end of the day, just to meet the people who are coming in and hopefully bring more people in. And if I'd given myself, you know, key performance indicators to like track that success, then maybe I'd have been disappointed at the outcomes, but maybe also since my motivation would have been different, I'd have taken a different direction on how I set it up. Instead of it being super informal and just things I enjoy, maybe I'd try to optimize the desires of the whole company. And that's a separate conversation, but it's more about, you know, understanding the motivations, whether your own or whether the company's motivations, and then using that to structure what you want to do. I did it because I enjoyed it. And to me, if I enjoyed it and people had fun, that was a success. And, you know, if we want to increase engagement by 17%, then the path I take is different.
I admire when I notice your humility and your curiosity, but also just your desire to and the value you place on helping other people feel welcome. You know, that psychological safety you talked about, critical factor. It's people like you that help create that space for other people to feel welcome and comfortable. And as surprising as it may be, people don't often feel welcome and comfortable to share their ideas. It's hard. And in our environment, we really, really want people to have that psychological safety to share, because we really want to, as a company, learn from the experiences of the people here, because we value the experiences and the perspectives that people bring. And this is, you know, part of that art of being human thing. Like, we actually respect and want to integrate people's perspectives and have them participate in what we're doing and our success. And I just want to call out that I notice that in you, and it's probably why I would think of you as part of the furniture, even though you're relatively fresh. It's those traits about you that I notice. So it's helpful to have, you know, people like you around with that mindset to create space for others so that they can then create space for others. It's this reciprocal feedback loop, right?
I think with psychological safety, one of the things that's often forgotten is the value in challenging people, because psychological safety might be the right, it's the right place to you know, be the idiot, to you know, give your ideas, to not feel worried about how people are going to think. But it's also the openness to be able to challenge people and to kind of reach out to them and feel safe in providing feedback. I always joke with people, are you going to fire me? Especially leads, I'll say, are you going to fire me next week? Because I want the honest feedback. And with coworkers, I want to feel safe that I can approach them and say, you know, like, are you approaching this in the way that's most genuine? I've had the best example I have, which is a quite funny one, is you said we would touch back on the Mongolian horseback riding. I announced to the whole company that I was going to go to Mongolia to train horseback archery. Does anyone want to come? Because there was a group discount and I wanted to save money. That was the motivation for me. I just threw it out into the void. If people want to come on, it means it saves me money. And I was getting into a conversation with a coworker who was like, oh, I wish I was more adventurous. And I said, well, come on the trip. Go to Mongolia with me. And there was a bit of a pause. You know, maybe I'm not that adventurous. And I think it's important to have those situations where you push people and they learn a bit more about themselves.
Yeah, that's beautifully said. I love what you're saying about psychological safety. It isn't about hearing and agreeing with everybody what they're saying. It's about willingness to engage in a meaningful conversation, which includes pushback, editing of ideas, updating of ideas, introduction of new thought processes to what you were trying to offer. And it's about engagement and participation and partnering with each other. And that is actually the, you know, why psychological safety is so important is it allows us to collaborate and be more cohesive as people. You talk about feedback. Feedback culture is so critical. And it's something that we've been, you know, encouraging for a very long time. But yeah, you really hit, I think, a really poignant note there about what psychological safety actually means and what the value of it is. So yeah, thanks for summing that up in such a clear way.
I joke with my leads that I was used to a Irish machinist kicking down my door and swearing every word that exists at me. So don't feel bad about telling me the truth.
Right.
Because I will improve because of it. The last thing I want is, you know, someone kicking down the door and saying, that was a great job, when actually they want to stab me. I'd rather you know, tell me. It's important for me to not just foster the, you know, situation where I can be honest with people, but also, you know, kind of overblow my own criticism in front of others so that they can be like, oh, no, you know, it's not that bad, but you could look at doing this. I'm like, there we go. We've unlocked what you actually wanted to say.
The heuristic that I use for that is I'll ask my leads from time to time in one-on-ones, what is it that you wish I knew about myself? And me asking my lead that, I can always see them kind of sit back in their chair and go, oh, geez. But often they'll say something meaningful. And even if they don't, though, what I'm trying to do is encourage them to know that, hey, I want to know what you're thinking. So share with me so that I can improve. Because my intentions are just to do a good job in meaningful ways and do meaningful things. And I think I'm doing that. And if I'm not, please be one of the people that shares with me what you wish I knew. So yeah, we've got a similar value of transparency there. It's quite nice. Getting from the producer to wrap up here. So hey, Ben, thanks. Ben, thanks for that chat. It was really great. We actually just unpacked a bunch of threads that I think should be part of follow-up conversations that we should probably have. So I look forward to doing that and hope you're able to do that. I hope you had a nice time on the podcast today.
It was a lot of fun. So thank you for inviting me to ramble at you for an hour and a half.
It was glorious. Hey, let's end with five questions. These are simple questions. I'd just like to get a sense from people. So first question, cats or dogs?
Neither.
Nice. Coffee or tea?
Well, seeing as I consider coffee to be the greatest sin of man, I'm going to say tea.
There you go. Are you a morning person or a night owl?
Definitely morning.
All right. Books or movies? What do you prefer?
Books.
All right. Beach or mountains?
Mountains.
All right. I think that's five. Benny, is that five?
That's great.
I'd say it's five.
Thanks, all right. Thanks everyone, for joining
yeah.
me. And we're back. So I'm just going to say this right now. I'm going to put it out there because Ben's going to listen to this and I want him to hear it for sure. I took a lot away from this conversation. And the big two things that I learned from Ben, you know, he really put a hat on it for me, was you got to set goals and know what it is, like a form of measurement, so that you know when you're doing a thing. You can't just use a state of mind or a vibe check to like actually have a goal. So I really appreciated that part. The second part was it's okay to start things and then quit them. You know, you don't have to be number one or the best or, you know, out there hitting dingers all the time. It's okay to just get on base and take a look around and get an understanding of it. So I appreciate all that. That was my big takeaway from it. But Clayton, what did you get out of the conversation?
Yeah, I just thought it was such a refreshing way to look at life. You know, those two examples that you bring, it just demonstrates that Ben isn't thinking about, well, I'm doing a thing, so I'm pot committed, I can't stop, and I'm a failure if I'm not the best at it. Like, if you take those two things out of most equations, like, it's so refreshing and so enabling to look at, oh, this is just an experience and larger arc of my life, and I'm going to learn some things from it. I'm going to get some experiences out of this, and then I'm going to move on to the next thing. And it's just a powerful way to look at life. And it is not the way I look at life. So it was really eye-opening for me and energizing. I loved it. Oh, and another thing that I got out of that conversation was just the power of his ability to just ask the question that other people aren't willing to ask. That's where the professional idiot thing really gets exemplified. And that's the powerful piece that I took out of it. The meta narrative that emerges is this professional idiot thing. But I think that's what will resonate with the audience, in that some people will see themselves in that and maybe be less deprecative of themselves. I maybe just made up a word. But other people will see people they know in that. It's like, oh, this person that I'm around all the time, that when I'm around this person, great things happen, and I've never thought about why. It's maybe because of these attributes that Ben is offering. So I think it's a little bit of a signal to both sides of the audience.
Yeah, we'll I can add to that by saying, if you go back and listen to the Kelly Jardine episode, she has the point of saying, I asked a question in the room that nobody else wants to ask.
Beauty. Absolute
and
beauty.
And it's funny because she kind of frames it not in the same way, but the same idea. And then when you take a look around, you see the value that we actually place on these people. They're the ones that we call when there is a problem to be fixed, or we move them around into problematic areas because we know that they can solve the problem because they're willing to address the problem. So,
but that's the beauty. They don't solve the problem. They enable other people to solve the problem. They get better at, hey, it's that Socratic method, right? What's the problem you're trying to solve? Then you can really broaden the ability of people around you to participate once you've clearly defined the problem. That is the thing, the skill that so much of us are conditioned to have a solution, that we go, we hear the problem and we never say it again, but we talk about solutions. And then we got people head nodding and yeah, yeah, yeah. But actually, one of the lost skills is, what's the problem we're trying to solve here? It's this. Oh, I actually don't think it's that. I think it's this. Oh, right. It is that. And then there's this moment of like, holy, we have more and more clarity. And when you have clarity, more people around you can actually contribute to the solutions. This is like in a self-management organization, this is why we talk about distributed decision-making. Like that's how you make it happen, right? It has to do with sense-making. Like the world's too complicated for any one of us to make sense of all the things, but we need to make sense of our environment to move forward in a way that solves problems. And to do that, we need to engage the group mind. And these people just kind of naturally or have developed a skill that allows the group mind to emerge more easily. And this is why we love them, this because they make us more powerful. Because when we're around them, better things happen. And that's why we love people like Jar Jar and Ben and other people that do that.
Yeah, Ben even has that moment where he says, sometimes I'll throw out a solution and I know it's not going to be the one that we pick, but then at least people will build on it to get to the right or the more right solution. So yeah, I do think there is a lot of power.
Having the humility to do that is rare too. Because a lot of people will think, oh, if I'm not right, I don't want to share. These people move way past that and enable the rest of us not only to, they model a behavior that allows us to come up with better solutions, but it also models the behavior of us to be willing to share ideas that may or may not be right and get us past this ego-driven thing that forces us to think, oh, if I don't have the right answer, I don't want to say anything. Like, we need to unleash more and more people, and that's a way to do it, by having people like this around to catalyze. So it's beautiful.
I guess that really makes sense of the idea of professional idiot, because that is, it's embracing that, like, people don't say something because they're scared they're going to sound dumb, right? I don't want to say something because I'm scared I'm going to sound dumb. I'm going to sound like an idiot, so I'm not going to say anything. And then someone shows up and says, like, you know what? I'll say the wrong thing, but it'll move us forward. It'll move the entirety of the thing forward. And I think that very much encapsulates everything you were just kind of saying. It takes a lot of humility to do that. What a treat that was.
What a treat. I think to be a person that values getting to right versus being right is so powerful. I just want to get to right. I'm not concerned about being the one that had the right answer. That's such an amazing mindset that just enables other people. So that's what I see in Ben and Kelly. But okay, let's try our...
That's our first one back from Clayton's sabbatical. I don't have a sabbatical probably for another few months, so don't worry. We'll keep chipping away at our 100 episodes goal. But I think in the spirit of Ben expressing how important it is to set a goal and us working at IQmetrics/Chrysalis, we should set a goal based on a former goal, which involves the number 10,000. How do you feel about that, Clayton?
It's perfect. It's a good throwback.
But 10,000 what? We don't know yet. We'll figure that out. Could be dollars, streams, downloads. I don't know. We'll get there because it's okay to say that you don't know. So until next time, keep reaching for the stars.
Awesome. Just awesome.
Unpacking Chrysalis, the art of being human. Thank you.